and good evening to you, everybody. Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Kevin. Now, if there's a distinctly country flavour about the show tonight, then you will know why when you meet my guest for the evening. He was born in Canada of Romanian parents, and he worked in radio in both Canada and the United States. He came over at this side of the Atlantic in the mid-60s to work on the high seas as a DJ with Radio Caroline, presenting what they called the biggest country show this side of Nashville. I know you've already guessed his name, because he has just become the newest voice on Radio Carousel. I get mixed up before I go on to further. He is, of course, Daffy Don Allen, or Don Allen to us. Don, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much indeed, Porgy. It's nice to be on the show.
Now,
it seems funny to be sitting here.
Well, it seems even funnier for me to be sitting here. How did I do for the beginning? Is that an accurate description?
Very accurate. Very accurate indeed.
Now, how did it all begin for you?
Well, I don't know. I always look back at it in retrospect now. There's a song that Gene Stewart, who's a very good Irish singer, came out with. The song's called I'm Just Lucky, I Guess. And, you know, since I've heard that song, I sort of look back as the years go by, and there must be... let's say it's 1965 to 1982 is something like 17 years ago. I came over here for a holiday. And at the same time, before coming over to England for a holiday, I was working between radio jobs. I was working for a firm known as the Canadian National Railways. And coming back from Winnipeg one time to Vancouver, I picked up this old weekend magazine, you know, these colour supplements that you get out of newspapers. And there was a very interesting article about this ship broadcasting from the high seas. And I thought, well, why over in Europe do they have to broadcast from ships? I couldn't understand this. And at the time, I'm sure as everybody appreciates, radio was state-controlled. Even, say, Radio Luxembourg, you know, state-controlled. There was no such thing as free... I'll reword that. Commercial radio in the sense... But I didn't realize this, you see, because I took commercial radio for granted, being a Canadian and having traveled extensively throughout America. And I just could not grasp this, that radio was not commercial over in Europe. I'd never been to Europe. So upon arrival in England, I had this clipping from the newspaper, and I was very, very curious about this. And, you know, when I get curious about something, I'll follow it right through. And lo and behold, to cut a long story short, I wish you had more than an hour, so I could go on that one subject alone. But anyway, to cut a long story short, I went up to London one day, and I walked into Caroline House. And this just keep in mind what I said. I'm just lucky, I guess. I walked into Caroline House, and there was everybody and everybody in there, right? I walked up, and I said to the receptionist, "Good afternoon. I'm a radio announcer from Canada. Could I see the setup?" She said, "Are you a disc jockey?" And we don't use that term, or we didn't use that term in Canada at the time. I said, "Radio announcer." And we sort of came to a conclusion that a disc jockey is an announcer, announcer is a disc jockey. And next thing I knew, this program director of the South Ship came up to me and said, you work in radio?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Would you like a job?" And I said, "Are you having me on?" First of all. And anyway, he interviewed me. I didn't do an audition. And to cut a long story short, again, next day, I was on a ship called the Mi Amigo, which was bobbing up and down like a cork in the water off the front of the Essex coast. I'd never been to sea in my life. And that was the beginning of my...
Oh, my goodness, career. You know, it's harder to get a job on Radio Carousel than that, let me tell you. But
I didn't do an audition either.
Okay, well, I had to do it. Before we move on to the high seas DJing, let's have a look at radio in Canada. How did you first become interested in radio?
Oh, like that goes back to when I was about 8 years old. I used to listen to commercial radio in my hometown. And at first I visualized that this was a very glamorous life. And a lot of people get the false impression it is a glamorous life, you know, because they only see the disc jockey or the person in radio when he's on the air, or they listen to him, he sounds happy. And I didn't realize there was all sorts of other implications involved in radio that sometimes don't sort of relate to a happy-go-lucky job, which I was to find out later on. Anyway, my original application to join a radio station was before I received training in America, and I was accepted. I was allowed to do dog's body jobs, if you want to put it that way. You know, like, say, do a late-night Saturday show for somebody who didn't want to because he wanted to go, had a prior engagement. And at the same time, waking up early on a Sunday morning to take out the necessary equipment to do an outside broadcast, say, from a local church, you know, things like this. And this is how you really get your start. You know, you've got to sort of really be a lapdog. You know, you've got to sort of offer to do anything at any time, anywhere, just to get your foot in. And then I was told that with my voice, things like this, I had the potential to be a disc jockey, but it would be in my best interest to be properly trained. So I went to America to be properly trained, which, of course, was a fallacy, because when I came back to Canada, you may not grasp this situation, but Canada and America are two separate countries. They have their own pronunciation of certain words and things like this. And I was educated in America radio-wise. When I came back to Canada, it was like starting all over again, although I got basic training on how to do everything from compile the news, because in a lot of these stations in Canada and America, they're one-man stations after 6 o'clock. You virtually have to run out into the newsroom. You've got to tear the news as it comes off. It's fed down the wire, you know, and things like this. And you've got to compile it while records are playing, things like this. And you've even got to know how to sort of put the station back on the air. And if it's really complicated, then you phone up the engineer. Well, things like this, they teach you the basics of radio. But when I came back to Canada, I was very disappointed that I had a lot of things I'd learned were of no value to me in Canada, because they were American ideas, and I had to, but at least I'd made a step in the right direction. So my first full-time job was within the Arctic Circle in Canada. And a lot of people think, hey, it's cold up there, you know, but it was very warm. Actually, it was a very warm winter that I was up there. It was a place near the Manitoba-Saskatchewan border, and it was, as I say, the name probably won't ring a bell. It was a funny little town, actually. It was one of these forts, to begin with, you know, where the Indians traded skins and that in the early days, and later became known as Flin Flon, believe it or not. It was named after some character, like a comic strip character. But I spent the summer and winter up there, and then I went on to Port Arthur, Fort William, and I worked in radio and television. I got thrown in television, the deep end. When I look back on it now, it's a joke, but it wasn't a joke at the time. The chap whose mother owned the radio station was supposed to be the sports director and sports announcer, and he was covering a hockey game, and he didn't arrive one Sunday, and there was only me, lo and behold. That was my first debut date on television, and I was powdered down. You know, they got to put the talcum on you so you don't shine like a greasy egg. And given the sports scores, that was it. I was told I was on the air in 2 minutes flat or something, and I was frightened. I was very frightened. That was my debut in television.
Well, how did you do?
Well, I read the scores out, but I was very frightened. You know, I'm not afraid to admit it now, because, as I say, I'm looking at all this in retrospect now, and it was very funny, but it wasn't at the time, believe you me.
Well, staying with radio in Canada and the United States, I think we'd better tell our listeners something of the setup over there. You know, you have stations by the million, literally, isn't
well,
that right?
There's a lot of stations. The best way to grade them is you've got your big city stations. When you're a big star, you work on those. You've got your middle market stations, which are neither big or small. And then, of course, you've got your small stations, which would serve, when I say small, I'm not talking about the popularity of the station, the vicinity. Like, say, for instance, Radio Carousel, it's in a small town. Oh, well, I mean, Navan is not a city. And a station of this size in Canada would be sort of described or indexed a small town station. Community radio, really.
Yep.
This is what it's all about. And this word community radio is really sort of, you know, it's being used time and time again now, because basically what this station does is serve the community. And this is what these small stations are. And when somebody wants to get into radio, unless you're sort of a megastar, you don't start in the big market or the middle market. You take step one, the small market station, which is a small town station, which I worked in, and you work your way up into a middle market station. Well, when I was in Flin Flon working at this community station, it was called CF AR, I believe. Oh, this is well over 20 years ago. And I moved from there to a middle market station, which was down in the Lakehead, on the at the close to the Great Lakes in Canada. And this was considered to be a middle market station. It was a radio and television station combined, you know, radio station upstairs and television station downstairs. The television station was to serve that vicinity. Other than that, they relayed CBC programs, things like this. And then from there, I went to America. And I worked in Los Angeles for a little over a year in radio and also for the biggest airline company in the world, Douglas Aviation, full-time, radio part-time.
Don't tell me you were flying planes.
No. I was actually, I was in the section that you may have heard some years ago in the 60s, and they had these U-2 spy planes. In order for these planes to be successful in doing what they were doing, they had to have added fuel tanks, right? This is getting away from radio. But I was working full-time in this section that actually manufactured these auxiliary fuel tanks. And they used those first, and then when those were empty, they just flicked a switch, and the thing, you know, the fuel tank just went off the wing, and then they went on to their own conventional fuel, or their and I was working there full-time at the Douglas
Airport. Indeed, there was a famous court case about U2's
Gary Powers,
he was shot down over the United States.
Well, it may have, I may have made one of those fuel tanks for him.
Okay, Dan, well, stick around, because we have lots more to talk about. In the meantime, we'll continue with some country music that I'm sure Don used to play. Welcome back. Porrick Welch here with you until 8 o'clock on Radio Carousel, 210 metres on the medium wave. And in case you don't know it by now, my guest this evening is none other than Don Allen, a very famous man who has travelled the world. Now, Don, we were just talking about the U2 a few minutes ago there. And from building fuel tanks for U2s in California, where did you move on to then?
Well, my visa ran out in America, so I came back to Vancouver. And again, you know, this is possibly the first time I've mentioned this, because I thought, well, you know, I should never sort of mention the dull part of my life. But it's not been all that glamorous, actually, because when I arrived in Vancouver, I was what you might call penniless and broke. It's happened to me once or twice. I think about the only time I can really remember when I was really, can we use that word, heaven forbid, destitute. And I arrived in Vancouver, sussed up the radio stations in Vancouver, and, you know, for every announcer, disc jockey working in radio, there must have been at least half a dozen of them walking the streets waiting to get in, because Vancouver is the warmest part of Canada. And, of course, everybody goes to the West Coast. In fact, my family moved out there for my mother's health, you know. She's a very old woman, but she's perfectly healthy because of the climate. So when I came up to Vancouver, I generally took all sorts of anything at all, you know, just to survive. And I got a job in a very famous steakhouse. If anybody ever goes to Vancouver, be sure to drop into Mr. Mike's. It's on Granville Street. Some very tasty barbecued charcoal broiled steaks, you know. In fact, every time I go back to Vancouver now to see my folks, I make a pilgrimage down there and have a steak. But the price has gone up. It used to be $1.19. It's about $5 now, you know. I managed to get some weekend work in a few of the stations. Again, dog's body jobs type of thing. And it was at this time when I was working for Canadian National Railways full-time and radio part-time, whenever I could fit it in, that I came across this article on Radio Caroline. And I was determined, you know, I just could not understand why these people were broadcasting from a boat. To me, it was, you know, just totally senseless. Anyway, I'd saved a few dollars, decided, you know, see Europe, Paris, London, places like that, came over here, and consequently, just pure professional curiosity led me to Caroline House. And this is when Caroline was, I don't think it had actually reached its peak yet. There were people there, unknown people, but very, very dedicated people who were yet to be discovered. Names like Simon Dee, Tony Blackburn. I remember Tony Blackburn very, very well, because in the early days, they called him Tico, because his hairdo resembled a tea cozy that you put over a tea cozy, you know, put over a teapot to keep it warm. There are people like him.
But yes, he still tells those inane jokes that he tells now.
No. He, I'll tell you who he got that from. He got it from, he picked up a lot of things from various disc jockeys and blended them all together. And he got that from a disc jockey known as Keith Skews, who now is the managing director of a radio station in Yorkshire. But Keith was a very, very intelligent announcer and a very witty announcer. And, of course, Tony Blackburn took his style in some way, shape, or form. But you see, I think the thing that really got Tony his break was that he was young, he was good-looking, and he was the first voice to be heard on Radio 1 in Britain. But I think he had his youth and good looks. He was a good disc jockey to a certain degree, too, but no disrespect to him, but I don't think he was as original as he would like people to think he was. Because I knew Tony when people didn't know Tony. When Tony didn't know how to cue up a record, he was on Caroline Cell. And then he went to Radio London and said that he owed all his, you know, all everything that he has achieved in radio so far, he owed to Radio London, whereas in actual fact, anybody who worked on Caroline in the early days knows that Tony owes everything to Ronan O'Reilly and Radio Caroline. There's a lot of people that owe Radio Caroline.
Well, before we get on to Radio Caroline itself, tell us something about Simon Dee, because I remember seeing Simon when he had made it very famous on television in England, you know.
Well, Simon, again, you see, I said about Tony Blackburn, he had his looks and his age, and that he had that going for him. And he was only a youngster, I think he was in his teens at the time. Now, Simon Dee had a gimmick going for him. He was, officially speaking, the first voice to be heard on Caroline. Simon was a very easygoing bloke. I think success came, I hate to say this because, you know, I'm very fond of Simon. He was a great character to work with. And there was nothing temperamental about him at the time. However, I think success got to him too quickly, like the Beatles, you know? The Beatles just were instantly discovered and suddenly, boom, success overnight, and it was too much to handle. They tried everything. They went to India, they tried meditation and all this. Well, Simon, being the first voice on Caroline, he had that gimmick going for him. After he left Caroline, he went on Luxembourg, then he went on Radio 2, and then he had his own television show, and everything just fell out of the sky. Everybody who's been on Caroline has been very fortunate that I can remember. I mean, I could name names like Tony Blackburn, Simon D. There's just two of them. Now, success just rained out of the sky for them. They didn't go seeking. I don't believe that Simon actually was seeking a job on 208. I think 208 were after him. You know, Radio Luxembourg, the same as BBC Radio 2, or the Light Program, and his television program. I think everything just fell into place because he was the first voice on Caroline, and that was a gimmick.
And of course, you worked with Tony Prince as well.
Tony. I remember Tony in the old days when he had his Oldham E-Bag Gummax then, you know. In fact, he's still got some of his tapes, so. Tony sounds very, very polished now. He's extremely polished. He's been with Luxembourg for about 14 years. But when Tony arrived on Caroline in the early days, he was, you know, the only thing that was missing was his welly boots and his little flat cap and pork pie. He was straight out of Oldham. But his heart was in entertainment, you know, and he's determined little fellow he is. It seems small people are always more determined than bigger people. And Tony did graft. He wasn't accepted entirely at first, but eventually he was accepted. He was sent down to the South Ship at one stage to newsread, and it was totally out of his, you know, it was just wasn't on. Tony was not a newsreader. Tony was a disc jockey, an exhibitionist, an extrovert. I've been with Tony in some very embarrassing situations, which I won't go into detail, involving us both in the Isle of Man. You know, I've seen him sort of go through his whole paycheck in the Isle of Man casino, you know, 2 weeks on board, and suddenly he gets off, and the same night he loses 2 weeks' pay in the Isle of Man casino. But, I mean, this was Tony. Tony is a laughable, lovable, happy-go-lucky bloke. And after 14 years at Luxembourg, he still is. I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago on the telephone. You know, he hasn't changed, except for his age.
Well, to put it bluntly, Don, what was it like out in the middle of the sea playing records?
It's not the first time that question's been asked. In fact, when Caroline got towed away, I was offered, I won't go into detail, but I was offered a substantial sum of money by a Sunday paper to disclose the gory side of Caroline. You know, how these journalists like to sort of turn the coin over and say, well, really, it wasn't that glamorous, was it? You know, tell us all about it. Were you organized? Was it chaos and things like this? And if so, glorify it. Tell us all about it. And I couldn't do it. I didn't even sort of think about it. You know, the journalist, when he first offered me the money, I said, no, I couldn't do it. And he thought maybe, you know, everybody's got their price to pay. I even discussed the thing with Ron O'Reilly, and he said, well, you know, it's your own conscience. Tell what you want. I don't know what it was like out there. You lads do. He says, but if you can live with your conscience afterwards, Caroline is dead, you know. Let it rest in peace. There were, to a certain degree, it was very unorganized. I'll go so far as to say, I'll give you one instance that I find rather amusing. In its heyday, Radio Caroline was, it was just bristling with success, no matter which way you looked at it. There were agencies clamoring, queuing up to advertise on Caroline. And everybody in Caroline House down in London was in a very posh part of London. And there were so many people walking about in Caroline House that one did not know whether these people were working for Caroline or whether they were just browsing through. It got to that state. Now, I can remember one chap called Jim Murphy, Murph the Surf. His wife was sitting in the foyer waiting for him one day down in Caroline House, and the two directors, Ellen Crawford, who owned Radio Atlanta, and Ronan O'Reilly, who owned Radio Caroline, you know, the two of them merged. The big Caroline came north to the Isle of Man, which broadcast the north of England and Ireland, and the small ship, Radio Atlanta, was renamed Radio Caroline. So these two directors had a fallout or something. I don't know the details of it, but Alan Crawford, Ronan's partner, one of the directors, main directors of the Caroline organization, came down. He was in a foul mood, and he actually sacked Jim Murphy's wife, who was waiting for him in the foyer. And she wasn't even employed at the station, you know. But he just took it that everybody in that house was employed, everybody in that building was employed. And, you know, there were pop stars walking in and out. It was just the in place to be. When you're in London, you know, you see people like Mick Jagger, Eric Burdon, Cilla Black, walking in and out, Tom Jones, various American stars over here on tours, Ike and Tina Turner, things like this, coming in to do promos and things like this. And it was like a crossroads. You know, it was the in place to be. It was Caroline House.
Well, I wasn't looking for the sordid details, Don. All I was really looking for...
Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, you asked me about the ship. What was life like on the ship?
Yeah.
Well, put it this way. We were well looked after. The food was good. We had duty-free cigarettes. Booze was there. You know, it was all duty-free. It was as if you were in another country, really. The only thing they didn't do when you came off the ship was stamp your passport. But they would go through your suitcase... And if there's anything that you took out, like, say, an expensive tape recorder, portable tape recorder, radio, jewelry, anything like that, you had to declare it in the customs hall in Ramsey, Isle of Man. Otherwise, you were bound to pay duty when you came back in. Why, I don't know, because, you know, okay, but it was, technically speaking, it was as if you were going to another country. Even the laundry had to be, everything had to be sort of in triplicate at first. And... life actually on the ship, a lot of people, the first thing they say, was there any women on the ship? No, there was never any women on the ship. We lived, breathed, ate, and slept radio. And I know this sounds very monotonous, but when you're really into radio, 3 years on Radio Caroline was equivalent to 9 years in an ordinary radio station. Because when you take on average... You work, well, one third of the day, the other one third of the day is leisure, and the other one third is sleep. You know, just sort of base it on that. And so, therefore, 1 year of that type of radio, where you spend one third of the day at the radio station, we were spending three thirds of the day on Radio Caroline. So that's equivalent to, I would say, my 3 years on Caroline was equivalent to 9 years of, say, perhaps working on Carousel or any other station.
Well, did you find it boring, or did you find
not
it
not at
hard?
All, no. If I'd have found it boring, I don't think I would have been there for three. I think I would have been off, actually, after the first couple of months. I was dedicated to radio like, well, how can I put it? I was truly dedicated to radio, and I didn't realize that at the time, but as I look back again in retrospect, it was one of the most exciting, if not the most exciting thing that ever happened to me.
And, of course, you did 2 weeks on, two weeks off.
Well, originally on the South Ship in early 65, it was 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, with pay. You were paid while you were off. So you did 2 weeks out of a month, and you were paid for 4 weeks. And the pay was exceptionally good for that. Was it good? It was very good for that sort of, you know, that particular year. I spent March, April, May, June. I came off the South Ship because I'd never been to sea in my life. And I was all set to quit Radio Caroline because of health reasons. I just couldn't stand the sea. And then I was offered this job in Caroline House itself, which I did take from June until September, or was it November, I'm not sure, 65. And then they asked me if I'd go up on the North Ship just as a temporary replacement because... A few of the lads had shifted about. Tom Lodge had gone to Luxembourg. And lo and behold, I agreed to it reluctantly. And I went up on the North Ship, and there was only one person that was left on the ship to carry on broadcasting. Jerry Layton was going off on the tender. Bob Stewart was the lone person left on the ship. So between him and I, we carried on for a week, just the two of us. You know?
Sounds like crisis point. Okay, Don, let's have another bit of music, because you've been talking all the time, and really you do deserve a rest, because you're very interesting.
So far from you, I'm sending on.
Yes, indeed, from here to there to you with Hank Loughlin, and reminding you, of course, that Don Allen is our guest, and he's just come dashing in because he had to go out and get a breath of fresh air. Really, I suppose we could call it the Don Allen Show today, because he is the person who is talking. Okay, Don, you're settled down again. Now, we were on Radio Caroline, and you were telling us about some of the, let's say, the daily routine that you went through, and how you had to rally together during a crisis point in the ship's life. In other words, two of you had to keep the boat going.
It didn't seem a crisis point, really. That's the joy of it.
Well, I suppose when you have this type of dedication, one doesn't count it as work. But let's move on to your own personal life, we say, during Carousel. By that I mean, you know, you were in the public eye in Britain, or certainly the public ear, and did your own life change because of this?
Well, I tried my very hardest not to...
Let's move on to your own personal life, we say, during Carousel. By that I mean, you know, you were in the public eye in Britain, or certainly the public ear, and did your own life change because of this?
Well, I tried my very hardest not to be in the public light when I was off. Because later on, when I made up my mind that I was going to stay on the North Ship, when we got off, I looked at it this way. I thought, well, 1 week out of three, you've got to yourself. And after being on a ship for 2 weeks, some people, on the other hand, love being in the public. Like, take Tony Prince, for instance. He loved doing gigs. I didn't. I just like to sit back and relax, go to places, and not be sort of known. I just like to be an average, you know, an average person. I think one loves publicity to a certain extent. I don't mind it if it's in newspaper form or things like this, but I'm not really one for delving into publicity where you've got to earn it by sort of going on a stage or something like that and entertaining people. I love to entertain people behind a microphone, but I think at that stage anyway, I was lost on stage, you know?
Yes, but you must have got the fan mail. And
The fan mail is... Oh, golly, yeah, the fan mail was really another... In fact, I had to start a fan club. I found it totally impossible to adequately and accurately answer the letters of people writing in asking similar questions that you're asking, you know, what's it like on the ship and things like this. And I found that I just couldn't handle it. Well, this one lady in Yorkshire offered to start a fan club for me. And I thought, well, this is, you know, it's a good thing because I'll just more or less give her an answer to all the general questions that are asked. And there's, you know, there's a general lot of questions. What's it like on the ship? And various other, you know, what does it feel like in when it's rough weather? Is the ship as glamorous as it looks from land and things like this? And generally, it was just sort of radio questions, you know, what do you think of Caroline? Things like this. And people writing in say, I'd love to visit the boat. It looked so lovely. When they did come out and see the outside of the boat, they thought, you know, it was absolutely glamorous. In fact, Tony Prince was one of the biggest offenders as far as exaggerating and stretching details. He used to tell people that we had waiter service out there, you know, things like this, and that we lived like posh gentlemen. Whereas in actual fact, we didn't. The crew were Dutch, and we had to adapt ourselves to Dutch food, things like this. It was just like, I don't know, it was ordinary life. There's nothing sort of special, I suppose. When I look back now, I say it's, you know, cigarettes being free and booze being free and food being free. You were well looked after out there. The food was exceptionally good because, of course, food was the main, you know, the main thing. There was no entertainment out there apart from television. And as I say, our booze is free, our cigarettes were free. And we got paid after enjoying ourselves for 2 weeks. You know, you can imagine what it's like. But the overall atmosphere on the ships was very, very good. Well, at least on the ship that, you know, the ship I was on, Radio Caroline North. On the south, I think there tend to be a lot of megastars down there, ones that sort of made it. Let's put it that way. However, there's people on the North ship, on Caroline North, that made it too, like Bob Stewart. He's on Luxembourg now. Tony Prince, he's on Luxembourg. There's but two people. Then, of course, you have Dave Lee Travis, who's on the south ship, and various other people. But the south ship, you see, was aimed at a specific audience, south of England, London. London, primarily, was their target. Whereas in... On Caroline North, we weren't specifically aiming at, say, Manchester, Liverpool, or Dublin, or anywhere like that. We were just the North. You know, people writing us from bits of Scotland, bits of the North of England, Ireland. I remember getting a lot of mail from the south of Ireland. In fact, a lot of people that I met since I've come over here in January are now, they were teenagers at the time when they listened to me. They're now married. They've got children of their own, you know. And they say, they never say to me, I remember you from Manx Radio or Radio Nordsee. A few of them have said Radio Nordsee, but the majority of them, by large and whole, always say to me, I remember you from Radio Caroline. And I was a teenager then. Now I've got children of my own. You know, my wife and I are... this is the only... It's instances like this when I realise that I have actually grown, you know, because I don't feel a bit... I feel as young as I did when I first came over here, but unfortunately I don't look it, you know.
Well, you saved me from being hypocritical.
I knew you were going to say, how old are you? You know, I'm over 21.
No, I didn't ask it. You're the same age as me, 29.
Yeah.
Now, we could stay talking about Radio Caroline all day, but, you know, I have so many more things to talk about that we might have to make two or three shows of it, and I know you wouldn't like that. Tell us... were you very sad the day she was towed away?
Very, very. I was on board. It was the saddest. I sensed it. Actually, I'll try to keep this as short as possible because this could get very sad. Have you got any Kleenex? actually, contrary to what a lot of people think, Radio Caroline was not. I repeat, was not closed down by government legislation. That is a fallacy, it's a farce. A lot of people seem to think that we were closed down because of the legislation that was introduced. I will briefly go into why we were closed down and try to keep it as short as possible. Radio Caroline, North and South, was being tendered, looked after by a Dutch tender company, which gave us food, didn't give us. They sold us food, men to look after the ships, and oil. To run the ships. Now, after the bill was passed, Caroline, I believe, was leased out. I won't go into detail there, but anyway, to cut a long story short and be as brief as possible about this, Radio Caroline continued to carry on broadcasting after September the 1st. It was outlawed, or rather, legislation was passed against it on the 15th of August down in the south. And all the offshore radio stations and the forts were legislated against on the 15th of August. The one exception was Radio Caroline North. Legislation was not passed on us until 15 days later. We're given a 15-day reprieve. It was passed on the at the end of August, 31st of August. On midnight, 31st of August, Caroline was legislated against by not only England, but the Manx government. You see, because we were off the Isle of Man. This is a very, very delicate situation, which is another story in its own right. However, the Isle of Man, feeling that after approximately 4 years of free publicity, which they would have had to pay thousands and thousands of pounds for, they weren't too happy about Caroline being outlawed, so to speak. So, anyway, we were legislated against it on midnight, 31st of August, and after that date, all the surviving ships that were on the high seas ceased to broadcast, apart from Caroline North and South. They were the lone survivors. The many programs, television program that were, you know, documentaries were done on the ship, and a lot of people thought, you know, it was only a matter of time, which we didn't realize at the time. But anyway, Caroline continued to broadcast, and it was on the fateful evening of March the 1st, I believe, that both Carolines were taken away by the Dutch tender company. Let me make that quite clear. Again, I stress, Caroline South and North were not closed through legislation. They were towed away because of unpaid bills for oil, men, and food. And as a result of that, the chains were cut. The anchor chains were cut. Both ships were towed into Amsterdam, or into Holland. And there was every possibility that these ships could have come back had the bills been met. The bills were never met. Therefore, Carolines, the two Carolines, began to rust in Amsterdam. The North ship was broken up for scrap. The South ship, there were a lot of free radio people who were determined that the South ship was going to survive. And in later years, the South ship was taken out of harbor, back out onto the high seas. to continue broadcasting. But as I say, the end of Caroline was because of unpaid bills and not government legislation. Now, the day that we first got wind of this, I saw this very powerful tug. It landed a couple of days before they actually came over to the ship. They pulled into Ramsey, and they were in constant communication with Holland by shortwave radio, and they were told when to cut the anchor chain, and it happened. On a Saturday evening, I had just finished my country show. We went off the air at 10 o'clock, and we watched a bit of television, myself and a few more fellas. And then about 2 o'clock Sunday morning, we were all set to go to bed, and we heard this thump on the side of the ship at 2 in the morning. I thought, you know, suspiciously thinking, what could that be? And I had it in the back of my mind, because this very mysterious tug that was parked about a mile away from us, and laying at anchor, very quiet, mysterious, no communication at all. Apparently men from that tug had come across, and they'd taken over the ship. They'd pirated it. You know, we were sort of a victim of our own fate. And they said they had their orders to sort of cut the anchor chain, which they did do. And late Sunday afternoon, we were towed away. It took them a whole day to cut the anchor chain. It was that powerful. We were towed away, and we were on the high seas for a week. The North ship was. The South ship was towed overnight into Holland. The North ship was towed all the way down the coast of England. And consequently, a week later, we landed in Holland. The ironic thing about it, if I just point this out, I started on Radio Caroline on March the 8th, 1965, and I last stepped off the ship on March the 8th, 1968.
The evenest 3 years you ever spent anywhere. Yes.
And a year to the date, to that date, I started on Manx Radio.
Yes, I was just coming to Manx Radio.
March the 8th is a very, very critical day for me, believe me.
He's gasping for breath. We'll give him another little rest. Here's some more music of that era from the Everly Brothers. Yes, indeed, the memories keep flooding back there. The Everly Brothers, it has Don all droopy-eyed here, remembering the good times. Now, Don, from when you were finally let off the ship on March the 8th, where did you go from there? Up to Manx Radio, is it?
Well, it was out of work in radio for not approximately exactly a year. In that period, I did, I think, one show which will be remembered by a lot of people. It was called the Caroline Revival Hour. This was in Radio Andorra, which I recorded in the Paris studios, or their studios in Paris. And this went out over the airwaves of Andorra with the intention that they were going to do a lot of this, but the reception in England, unfortunately, wasn't as good as they had hoped it would be. It got press coverage and things like this. But I had to quickly do that before I took up my position as program controller of Manx Radio. And I arrived there a year after the day that I stepped off of Caroline. That's when I started working for a living. I mean, Manx Radio was really work. You know, it was. I used to get up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes I'd never leave the place until about 2 o'clock next morning. It was very badly in need of what shall we say, Carolinizing. It was running on a local basis, but there was no glamour, and I sort of showed the disc jockeys were just like 8 to 5 people. I pointed out to the powers that be that, you know, this station is the only commercial radio station broadcasting in the United Kingdom, the only licensed one at the time. And it was the only thing that was left after the offshore things went away. And I pointed out to the powers that be how we could glamorize this a bit, you know, give everybody their name shows. What? They never heard of this. I mean, the Morning Man on a Monday would do evening shows on a Tuesday and noon shows on a Wednesday, and heaven knows what he'd be on Thursday. Anyway, we sort of institutionalized the station in as much as everybody got a name show, you know, like the chap who did morning show did from 7 until 9, 9 until 12 I did, and 12 till 3, etc., etc. And within a few short months, the radio announcers at Manx suddenly became disc jockeys. And, of course, my popularity on the North Ship and the signal, which was just about getting into Britain, like, say, Blackpool, places like that, people were starting to pick this up. I mean, you know, there was Radio 1 and there was Manx Radio. Manx Radio was very popular in the north, but people were clamoring to try and get better aerials to hear it. We were on very weak power then. And Manx Radio was very good to me in many ways. I left it after 3.5 years. And I think that speaks for itself as far as, you know, involvement in community radio goes. In fact, Manx Radio is the pioneer of community radio throughout the British Isles. And from Manx Radio, in late 72, I'd heard again through the grapevine of this ship, this multicolored pop ship broadcasting off the Frinton Essex coast, then suddenly being jammed going over to Holland. And I just sort of made it known that I was interested in the operations of the ship, and I was approached by two Swiss businessmen who, I think they were going to send a plane over to the Isle of Man, believe it or not, to pick me up and fly me back. These people, money was raining out of the sky for them. That's another story in its own right, but I mean, I was very well paid, very well looked after by these people. They couldn't believe somebody of my age had this much experience, you know. And I went over to Nordsee. I spent I suppose you could call them happy years on Nordsee, back on the high waves. And then somewhere between Manx Radio and Radio Nordsee, I was approached by BBC Radio Merseyside in Liverpool to do a country show because of my country involvement with Radio Caroline. And I started doing a country show for BBC Radio Merseyside on a part-time basis, on a freelance basis. Started in 70 and happily ended that on the 6 years later in 76. So while I was employed full-time at Manx Radio, I was flying over every fortnight to Liverpool to record these shows and to do mid-morning shows for them too when I was over there. And even when I left Manx Radio to go to the Pirate, RNI, I was still continuing to do my Merseyside shows. This was from 72 until 76. So I think that I like to look upon that as a sort of a precedent, Pirate and Establishment at the same time. It was a fluke. I don't think it would ever happen again.
Okay, Don. Well, in 1976, you left radio, and you became a sensible, hard.
Well, I became a sensible, suburban Mr. 9-to-5 right. type of thing. I thought I'd get radio out of my system altogether.
Okay, well, we've brought it up that far. Now, I find myself getting very confused here because I've 10 minutes left, and how I'm going to fit everything in, I do not know. However, we'll have a try. Now, first of all, country music is your big bag, I know. Tell us about the country music festivals.
Well, the country music festivals, I started going to them originally when they were in their infancy. The first one at Wembley, they didn't know whether or not it was going to be a success, quite honestly. The second one, I appeared on stage with Murray Cash, Mervyn Solomon was still sort of, you know, wondering whether or not he had done the right thing. I think after the third one, he more or less realized that, you know, country music. But it was people like, I'll put Jim Murphy before myself, because he was the one that started the country show in Caroline. And then when he went to the States, there was a vacuum there, which I filled. And I didn't sort of fill it because of its popularity, because country music was anything but popular when I started doing it after Jim left for the States. A lot of people used to look at me and shake their head and say, you know, you're onto a wrong frequency there. Country music is never going to. There's a very, very elite few that enjoy country music. And I continued to play this because I liked it. And there was an audience there for it. Murray Cash was telling me, Murray Cash used to do a half-hour country show on the BBC, and he said that the BBC library was so empty of country music. So here was him and I pushing country music when people just were shaking their heads. Now, today, country music is a big thing. It's a big industry in Ireland, in England, in Europe. And I think, in some respect, country music was my greatest downfall, because I think I missed a few opportunities. In fact, I wouldn't confirm this, but when I applied for a job at Radio Luxembourg, at a very, I think it was before I went on to Manx Radio, I was turned down because I was labeled at that time as a country or a hick DJ who knew nothing but country music. Funnily enough, for 3 years I was playing pop music on Caroline too, but that didn't count. I was labeled a country DJ, and I've always been labeled a country DJ. I've always had that country label, and yet I haven't done a country music show for 6 years.
Well, you've met many people in Wembley, of course.
When I was on Manx Radio, I used to faithfully go to these Wembley things every year. In fact, I stopped going in 76. 75 was the last year I was there. I've even been over to Nashville. I've met these people. I've eaten pancakes and sausages with them in restaurants. You know, this is the ironic thing. Over here, they're megastars. And yet when you go to Nashville, you can sit in a restaurant and look behind you and see Porter Wagoner or Lester Flatt sitting down eating sausages and pancakes. You get up and you walk over to them and say, I believe you're Lester Flatt. That's right. Who are you? I'm Don Allen from England. Well, sit down and have a cup of coffee, you know. But over here, they've got to put up a certain sort of stance. You know, we are over here as superstars. But over in Nashville, they're just as they will talk to you the way you're talking to me and I'm talking to you right now. You know, they're in their home patch, and they're so friendly and approachable. They're country music people, and their songs are so down to earth. You listen to any country song and they always tell a story of either sadness or joy. I've never heard a country song yet, well, I have, but the very few and far between, where somebody will not relate joy into sadness or sadness into joy. And this stands for most of the music. While I'm on that subject, can I mention Gene Stewart? Because he's an Irish singer that I've always had a lot of respect for. When I was on Manx Radio, I came across this record called Come On Home and Sing the Blues to Daddy. It had been released about a year. And I listened to it. And I couldn't believe that this was recorded in Ireland. I thought this was a Nashville sound. It was that good. His voice is so bassy. He's got a lovely, beautiful voice, as Gene Stewart. He'd have no trouble getting a job as a disc jockey. And I started playing this record, and lo and behold, I met the man about, 3 years later or something like that. And he was introduced to me, and he thanked me very much indeed for sort of, you know, getting this record going for him. In fact, it's, I suppose you could sort of, you know, how Tom Jones is related to
Green Grass of Home.
It's Not Unusual. That was his first big hit. Well, I think Gene Stewart could be related to Come On Home and Sing the Blues for Daddy. That's a record that will always stay in my mind as Gene Stewart. Nobody else. If I heard somebody else singing that, I could never visualize, you know, automatically Gene Stewart would come into the mind.
Well, what do you think of Irish country artists generally?
There's a lot of Irish country. My only criticism at this point, if you're looking for criticism, is that a lot of them will do cover versions of American artists, knowing that these records by the American artists are going to be released over here. But then again, you'll get some good, I mean, there is some very, very good Irish country. I've heard, and I've met Irish artists in Nashville recording songs in Nashville to capture that Nashville sound. You know, you get some of the big names like Pete Drake, Lloyd Green, to name but a few, Pig Robbins on guitar. These people are you know, they're institutions in their own right. You go over there, and if you've got, say, $3,000 to part with, you can get this Nashville sound for an album. Well, it's probably more now, but if you thought you could sing and you had the financial backing, you went over to Nashville, get these lads behind you. They're just session musicians, but they're very rich session musicians because they will back anybody who wants to, you know, record an album. And I've heard a few of these albums that were recorded by Irish artists in Nashville, and they're great. They're absolutely great. There is something, I won't say that you can't get it in Ireland, you can't get it in Canada, you can't get it in England. There's just something about this sound, Nashville sound. It's known throughout the world, just like Coca-Cola, you know? I mean, you can make a cola, but it'll never taste like Coke. And you can try to imitate the Nashville sound, but you will not come anywhere near it. Nashville sound is Nashville sound. I'm sure anybody that knows country music will agree, and anybody that's been in Nashville and heard this sound will agree. There's a certain sound that comes out of Nashville that cannot be equaled by anything at all, no matter where you go.
Yes, Don.
You're lost for questions, aren't you?
No, I'm lost for time. It's 3 minutes to 8 o'clock. And, you know, we were going to talk about Russia and what else were we going to talk about? Famous people you've met and...
I don't think we got time, actually.
No, we were going to.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're going to have to do a part two on this.
Well, that's fine with me. Okay. I must say, I find this very, very unusual, sitting here being asked questions, and you're sitting where I should be sitting.
Oh, well, you know, you have to vacate the chair sometime.
It's been a pleasure.
Look at Don, thank you very much. And I certainly found it interesting, and I know lots of other people found it interesting. So, especially for you, I'm going to play this one. I hope you like it. It's Gene Stewart, your own favourite.
Today is the first day of honky-tonk season. I'm gonna take in every honky-tonk in town. I've got a license to drink for lots of reasons. And honky-tonk season will be open all year round. Although your clothes were never packed, you left me a long time back. But you kept on fooling me by hanging around. Up until your hungry eyes could find a better prize. Found him last night and then you shot me down. Today's the first day of honky-tonk season. I'm gonna take in every honky-tonk in town. I've got a license to drink for lots of reasons. And honky-tonk season will be open all year round. I wouldn't try to touch your heart, because I'd have to climb a barbed wire fence. Well, this fool found out last night, all the other fools were right. But the brains of a buffalo nickel, that's 13 cents.
I'm afraid with the time at 1 minute to 8 o'clock, it's time for me to thank my very special guest, Daffy Don Allen. I found him most fascinating indeed.
I've got a license to drink for lots of reasons.
In the meantime, this is Porrick Welsh telling you to stand by for Tony Johnson, who appears at 8 o'clock. I'll be back next Saturday, please God. Till then, take care. And the time now is 10 seconds away from 8 o'clock. This is Radio Carousel on 210 meters on the medium wave, and you're now asked to stand by for Tony Johnson.
Radio Carousel!
With music, news, and information, you're tuned to Radio Carousel, 210 medium wave.
You're listening to Tony Johnson.
Music!
Radio Carousel!
Getting better every day.
You're listening to Kieran Murray.
This is a Radio Carousel public service announcement. John Langford was drunk when he careered across the road at 80 miles an hour and slammed in a head-on with another car, killing the young driver. But he was sober when he stood in the dock in Montgomery, Alabama to hear the judge's verdict on his case. The charge, first-degree murder. The verdict, guilty. The sentence, life in prison. A bit tough, you might say. It could never happen in Ireland. Maybe not, but penalties for drunk driving are stiff in this country now. The penalties for driving with an excess of alcohol in the blood are loss of driving license for a minimum period of 12 months, a fine of up to £500 and up to 6 months in prison. In short, if you're driving, don't drink. And if you drink, don't drive. This has been a Radio Carousel public service announcement.
One, two, three, four!
What have these names got in common? Supertramp, the Eagles, Thin Lizzy, Queen, and Bob Seger in the Silver Bullet Band? Well, they're all going to be featured in a brand new series of Radio Carousels live at the Time, starting Saturday the 2nd of April at 6 p.m. All the tracks you'll be hearing in the series will be taken from a wide cross-section of the best in American and British live LPs. So if you'd like to hear your particular favourite group on Live at the Time, do right now to Live at the Time Radio Carousel in Navan. And of course, tune in every Saturday from the 2nd of April onwards between 6 and 7 for an hour of the best live...